So this afternoon we're going to look at that chapter which Steve just read to us in 1 Samuel chapter 5, which has been described as one of the most bizarre chapters in the Bible. In fact, it's so bizarre that at times it almost seems comical. I mean, part of it reminds me of Humpty Dumpty, because an idol has a great fall and can't be put back together again. And then another part of it is, well, it's almost like a parody of a victory parade, where the triumphant Philistines take their winning trophy, the Ark of the Covenant, to three cities. But instead of happy, cheering supporters, there's terror, panic, and death. And there's also something else that's unusual about this chapter. It's all about the Philistines. Unlike every other chapter in 1 Samuel, there's no mention of the Israelites. Now, these events in chapter 5 are closely connected with what happened in chapter 4, where Israel lost two battles against the Philistines. In the first battle, about 4,000 Israelites were killed, a defeat which made the leaders of Israel ask the question, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? And after losing that first battle, the Israelites decided to take the Ark of the Covenant with them into the second battle. They used it a bit like a lucky charm, believing that they would win because of its power. Their thinking was the same as the character in the film Raiders of the Lost Ark, who said, "The army that carries the Ark before it is invincible." However, the Israelites soon learned the hard way that victory is not guaranteed by taking a sacred object with you, because they suffered a devastating defeat and 30,000 more of their soldiers were killed. And to make matters worse, the Ark itself was captured by the Philistines, who also killed the two priests who were carrying it, Hophni and Phinehas. And when their father Eli heard the bad news about the Ark and his sons, the shock made him fall off his chair and he broke his neck and died. And the extent of this disaster for the Israelites was put into words by the wife of Phinehas, who gave birth to a child and named it Ichabod, which means no glory, because God had allowed the Ark, the symbol of his glory, to be captured. And as we come to chapter 5, I'm reminded of the well-known first line in the Charles Dickens novel, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Because the Philistines might have used exactly those words to describe how the events of 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5 felt to them. In chapter 4, it was the best of times, with their military victories and capture of the Ark. However, as we shall see in chapter 5, it was also the worst of times for the Philistines. So chapter 5 is split into two main sections, and I want us to look at each of those sections and then think about what relevance this chapter has for us today. So the first section is the Temple of Dagon in verses 1 to 5. After the Philistines captured the Ark, they took it to Ashdod, a journey of about 30 miles. Ashdod was near the Mediterranean coast, just a few miles inland, and it was one of the five main Philistine cities, along with Gath, Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. And in verse 2, we're introduced to Dagon, the idol who the Philistines worshipped. Now, we don't know much about Dagon, because other than in this chapter, Dagon is only mentioned twice in the Bible. In Judges chapter 16, when the captured Samson was taken to the temple of Dagon in Gaza. And then in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, where there's the grisly account of King Saul's head being hung in Dagon's temple. Some people think that the appearance of Dagon was a bit like a mermaid, half fish and half man, but there's no real evidence for that. What we do know is that Dagon was a false god, just like the other false gods of the Old Testament, such as Baal and Asherah. And Dagon had his own temple, and the Philistines placed the ark inside it, and they did that for two reasons. Firstly, they believed it was Dagon who'd given them the victory over the Israelites, and they probably intended to offer a great sacrifice of thanks to him, just as they did when they captured Samson. And secondly, they believed that Dagon had overpowered Israel's God. They therefore put the ark beside Dagon to symbolise that the defeated God of Israel was in submission to their victorious God. It was as if the ark was bowing to Dagon. But in verse 3, we're told that something strange happened overnight, because early the next morning, the Philistines discovered that Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. It was now Dagon who was in a position of submission before the ark, and the people of Ashdod therefore had to pick up Dagon and put him back in his place. You might remember that the prophet Jeremiah mocked idols by saying that they were like scarecrows in a cucumber field, and they had to be fastened with hammer and nails. And that's probably what the people of Ashdod did with Dagon. They nailed him to the wall so that he wouldn't fall over again. How ironic that this idol, who they thought was so strong and who was responsible for their victories, didn't even have the strength to get up off the ground. And this emphasizes how ridiculous it was to regard Dagon as a god. And in complete contrast, here in verse 3, for the first time since its capture, the ark is called the Ark of the Lord, because the true God, Jehovah, had shown his power. And so with Dagon securely back in his place, the Philistines probably went to bed that evening hoping that Dagon's fall was just an accident and that all was now well. But verse 4 tells us that the same thing happened the following morning. Dagon had fallen again, but this time his head and his hands had been cut off, and they were lying on the threshold of the temple. And this second fall left the Philistines in no doubt. Dagon had been thrown down by a superior power, because his head and his hands hadn't broken off accidentally. They'd been deliberately cut off. When David killed Goliath, 1 Samuel chapter 17 says that he took Goliath's sword and cut off his head with it. And that phrase, cut off, is a translation of the same Hebrew word that we have here in chapter 5, verse 4. It's a cutting off that's been done deliberately, not accidentally. The head and the hands of Dagon had been deliberately removed, and what that symbolized was that Dagon had no wisdom, because he's got no head, and no power, because he's got no hands. He'd been first humbled by the first fall, and then, as it were, executed in his own temple. And his head and his hands had been placed almost contemptuously on the threshold, because the threshold was the doorstep, the place where everybody trod with their dirty feet. And it's almost as if Dagon had been trying to run away, to get out of his temple, and he'd made it as far as the door before he was cut down and killed. And there's also deep disdain in the phrase, Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. A literal translation is, only Dagon remained on him. And what that's saying is that when Dagon's head and hands were cut off, it didn't actually make any difference, because he couldn't think or do anything, even when he did have his head and his hands. So Dagon had now fallen twice. And those two falls have a clear similarity with what happened in chapter 4, where the Philistines defeated the Israelites twice, with the second defeat being more devastating than the first. Now in chapter 5, the Lord has defeated Dagon twice, with the second defeat also being more devastating than the first. The Philistines gave the credit to Dagon for their two victories in chapter 4. But the Lord has now shown by his two victories in chapter 5 that he's comprehensively stronger than Dagon. And you know, that should have made the Philistines ask a similar question to that which was asked by the elders of Israel. Why did the God of Israel allow the Philistines to triumph in chapter 4 when clearly he's stronger than Dagon? Why did the true God allow an inferior idol to triumph in chapter 4? And Psalm 78 gives us an answer to that question. It says that the Israelites provoked God to anger with their high places. They moved him to jealousy with their idols. And as a result, God sent the ark into captivity and gave the Israelites over to the sword. You see, God was in control in chapter 4, just as much as he was in control in chapter 5. The Israelites broke their covenant with God by committing idolatry. So he raised up the Philistines against them and allowed his ark to be captured. It wasn't really a victory for Dagon. It was all the work of the sovereign God. Now, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that this comprehensive, convincing victory for God over Dagon would have made the Philistines realise that they were stupid to worship an idol. But instead, verse 5 shows us that they were hardened in their idolatry. This is what sin does. So much so that they even created a superstition of showing great reverence to the threshold, to the doorstep. They didn't want to step on the place where Dagon's head and hands had landed, because they regarded it as too sacred to touch. So they would hop over the doorstep so they didn't touch it. It reminds me a bit, some of you might remember, the cricket umpire David Shepherd, who had a superstition of lifting his feet off the ground whenever a team was on what he regarded as an unlucky score. He believed that by lifting his feet up and down, it would somehow prevent him getting bad luck from that score. How ridiculous. And in a similar way, everyone who went into Dagon's temple followed this crazy superstition of refusing to step on the doorstep where Dagon's head and hands had landed. Now, if you imagine walking out the back of the church towards the kitchen after the service and hopping over the doorstep, that then you'd be doing something similar to what these people were doing, although I really hope no one will actually do that. But you know, even out of this superstitious practice, God brought honour to himself, because this lifting of feet over the doorstep made people remember God's humiliation of Dagon for generations to come. Now, as Christians, we should of course steer clear of everything that smacks of superstition. Have nothing to do with irreverent, silly myths, as the Apostle Paul puts it in 1 Timothy chapter 4. Touching wood, crossing your fingers, not walking under ladders, thinking that 13 is unlucky. They're all superstitious, godless, silly myths. But superstitions can so easily spread, even among God's people. And this is highlighted by this silly practice of not treading on the threshold, because some of the Israelite priests later copied this superstition. Can you imagine that? God had comprehensively defeated Dagon, and then some of those who were supposed to be the spiritual leaders of God's people started hopping over the doorstep in deference to Dagon. So much so that in Zephaniah chapter 1, God had to threaten them with punishment because of it. Superstitions are wrong, because at their core they imply that there's a power called luck that has an influence over our lives. And by implication, that power is a rival to God, and therefore it itself is a form of idolatry. And I know people who are very intelligent and sensible in many ways, but who sadly scoff and mock if you mention anything to do with God. Yet those very same people will say, "Wish me luck," or refuse to wear a number 13 football shirt. That doorstep in Dagon's temple could have been put to a much better use. It could have been used as a place for people to bow their knee and pray to the one true and living God who defeated Dagon. But instead, these people preferred their superstition and their idolatry. And that brings me to the second section, the trail of devastation, verses 6 to 12. Verse 6 begins with the words, "The hand of the Lord was heavy." Do you see the irony in that? Dagon was lying on the floor with no hands, and at the same time, the true God was using his hands. The Philistines thought that the ark of the Lord had fallen into their hands, but in reality, the Philistines had fallen into the hands of the Lord. In chapter 4, the Philistines were afraid of God's hand because they realized that he was the one who'd caused the plagues in Egypt. But after they won their great victory and captured the ark, their fear left them. But now God is going to show them that they were right to fear his hand, because it's heavy upon them. And in this phrase, "the hand of the Lord was heavy," there's an important word play that isn't obvious to us in English. The word translated as "heavy" comes from the Hebrew word kabod, the same word that forms the last part of the name Ichabod, because kabod can mean glory or heavy. Ichabod's mother said, "The glory has departed from Israel." But that glory was now in Ashdod, and its strength, its power, its heavy weight was seen in the way that God's hand was at work. And you know, when we look around us today, we can so easily despair, because it appears that God's glory has departed. We see a world that shows little interest or respect for God, but his glorious power is seen every time a person becomes a Christian. The Israelites were feeling defeated and dejected. They had no idea what was taking place 30 miles up the road in Ashdod. But God's glory was at work, even though they couldn't see it. And today we can be confident that God is working mightily right now in ways that we know nothing about, because God's power is never constrained, whether we can see it at work or not. And even if we feel defeated and dejected, the hand of the Lord is never shortened so that it cannot save. And that's an objective truth that doesn't change regardless of how we feel or if we see bad things happening around us, like churches closing, godlessness rising, and Christianity appearing to be weak. God is still working. He's still accomplishing his purposes, and nothing can thwart his plans. And verse 6 also tells us what the result of the Lord's heavy hand was. He terrified and afflicted them with tumours. Terrified implies destruction, damage and grief, because many Philistines died. They'd slaughtered many Israelites in chapter 4, and now the God of Israel was judging the Philistines. In addition, he afflicted them with tumours. And most commentators believe that the tumours referred to here are the swellings of bubonic plague that's spread by rodents such as mice or rats. And this view is strengthened by 1 Samuel chapter 6 verse 4, where it says that the Philistines sent a guilt offering of 5 golden tumours and 5 golden mice. The Philistines had feared the Lord because of the plagues he brought against Egypt, and now they were experiencing their own plague. And then in verse 7, the people of Ashdod realised that they couldn't stand up to the true God. They acknowledged that his hand was heavy upon both them and Dagon. They'd seen something of the might of the true God, but they still call Dagon our God. They'd rather worship a broken idol that they'd made themselves than submit to the God who'd made them. But because of God's heavy hand upon them, they decided that enough was enough, and therefore that the ark mustn't stay with them any longer. So in verse 8, they called a meeting of all the lords of the Philistines, which refers to the 5 rulers of those 5 main Philistine cities. And they asked them, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And their answer was to move it to Gath, which was about 12 miles southeast of Ashdod. Now, we're not told why they made that decision. It might be that they thought that the plague was associated with the coastal region, because that's where the mice were likely to have come from. So they thought that they should move the ark further away from the coast. If so, this would also explain why the ark was never sent to Ashkelon or Gaza, the 2 other cities on the coast. But the 5 rulers had no intention of letting the ark go back to Israel. They hoped that when they moved the ark to Gath, the same terror wouldn't occur there. And had that been the case, then they could have pretended that what happened in Ashdod had nothing to do with the ark, that it was just a coincidence that the ark was there when the tumours appeared. In other words, they could blame it all on the mice. And then they've used their own ancient equivalent of rent-a-kill to sort out the mice problem in Ashdod. But verse 9 says that when the ark arrived in Gath, God's hand was also against Gath, causing a very great panic. And the word translated panic is a word that's used elsewhere in the Old Testament to describe the terror that God brought on the enemies of Israel in war. It implies that the people of Gath knew that they were under attack from God, as both young and old people were afflicted with the tumours. So in verse 10, the ark was sent to a third city, Ekron, which was about 6 miles north of Gath. There doesn't seem to have been another meeting of the rulers to make this decision. Such was the panic of the people in Gath that they made the decision themselves. They just wanted to pass the buck, and Ekron was the nearest city. It had now become a deadly game of pass the parcel. We don't want the ark, you have it. And as the ark reached Ekron, the people there made an angry protest. They were convinced that the people of Gath must want to kill them. How could they possibly send that box of death to us? So in verse 11, another meeting of the 5 rulers took place. But this time, the people didn't ask the rulers for advice. They gave them instructions. Send the ark away. Let it go back to its own place. In other words, give it back to Israel before it kills a lot of us. They were terrified. And there was widespread panic and death because the hand of God was very heavy there. the weight of God's hand had increased. It was now very heavy. His judgment against Ashdod was heavy, but because the Philistines had continued in their idolatry, he'd increased his judgment so that it was now very heavy upon Ekron. And in verse 12, the terrible effect of God's judgment is described. Death, more tumours, and the entire city made an anguish cry to heaven for deliverance. These Philistines who defied God now cried out to him for help in their distress. The whole city sent up its prayer for mercy. And isn't that something we often find? That in times of illness and despair, even unbelievers will desperately pray to God, to the God who they've never before shown any belief in. When death casts its shadow, people who've confidently defied God all their life will suddenly turn to him in desperation, because the reality of death removes all confidence in what this world offers. And then thirdly, I want us to consider the teaching we discover. That well-known verse in 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 16 tells us that all the Bible is inspired by God. It's God-breathed, and therefore every word of it is profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness. Even in this seemingly strange chapter, God teaches us a number of things that apply to us today in 2026. Firstly, keep yourselves from idols. Keep yourselves from idols. Now, as many of you will know, the Ten Commandments were stored inside the Ark of the Covenant. The first two of those commandments say, "You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make for yourself a carved image, an idol, and bow down to it." And ironically, those commandments were there inside the ark as it was put into the temple of an idol. The Philistines had broken both those commandments. They worshipped a false god, and they'd made a carved image of it. Now, it would be easy for us to think that we're not guilty of idolatry. After all, you probably haven't imagined your own god or created an image of it. But idolatry is not just something that occurs when we carve images out of wood and then worship them. Colossians chapter 3 tells us that idolatry starts inside us, in our hearts. Whatever we love or crave more than God is an idol. As someone has put it, anything that absorbs our heart and imagination more than God is an idol. That could be a hobby, family, money, a car, a job, your home, your favourite football team, or a pop group. The list is endless. If we make the satisfaction of our own desires more important than God, then we are in effect worshipping ourselves and committing idolatry. And it's very easy to do this without even realising it. For example, I remember to my shame an idol that I once made. I was desperate to win the village tennis tournament. I know that might sound a bit sad, but I longed to get my name engraved on the trophy. After all, it would make me part of the history of the village forever. I tried and tried until eventually, after many attempts, I finally won the tournament and received the trophy. I was a bit like one of the Philistines, holding the ark aloft. I looked at that trophy with satisfaction, saw the names of all the previous winners, and then in great excitement, reached my name, only to find that the engraver had misspelt it. That was a real Dagon moment for me. My idol came crashing down, and I realised how foolish I'd been. And you know, The devil is so cunning that he can even tempt us to make legitimate things into idols. Even preferences to do with the Christian faith can become idols. The style of worship we prefer. The particular Bible version that's our favourite. If anything becomes more important to us than God himself, then it's an idol. And we need to turn from it and pray in the words of that old hymn. The dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. Can I ask you this afternoon, what's your idol? And are you prepared to tear it down? And if you're not, then you might find that God also gives you a Dagon moment, just like he gave to me. And then the second teaching for us from this chapter is that Christ is in all the scriptures. Jesus said these words in John chapter 5. You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me. What Jesus is saying is that he can be seen throughout the Bible, even here in 1 Samuel chapter 5. And let me explain one way that we can see Jesus in this chapter. It shows us that God is always victorious, even when it might appear that he's been defeated. God turned the defeats of chapter 4 into victory in chapter 5. God always wins in the end, and surely the greatest example of that was when Jesus died on the cross. His crucifixion was a bit like the ark being captured. It appeared as though God's enemies had triumphed. If the wife of Phinehas had been alive when Jesus was crucified, she could have pointed at Jesus and said, "Ichabod, no glory," because it seemed that God had allowed his own glorious son to be captured and killed in the same way that he allowed the ark, the symbol of his glory, to be captured. But Jesus turned defeat into victory. He rose triumphantly from the grave. From what seemed like the worst possible defeat, God brought the greatest ever victory. It was the best of times, brought from what appeared to be the worst of times. The cross was a moment of apparent total defeat that was actually the greatest victory ever. At the cross, God disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them. He defeated the devil, death, and the power of sin, so that as Christians we can say, "Where, O death, is your victory?" And then the third and final teaching for us from this chapter is that God gives a second chance. After the way the people of Ashdod and the surrounding area treated God, you might have thought that he had abandoned them forever and want nothing more to do with them. But thankfully, God is not like that. He's a gracious God, willing to give a second chance. And we see evidence of this in Acts chapter 8, where we read that after Philip had baptized the Ethiopian eunuch, Philip then found himself at Azotus, and as he passed through, he preached the gospel to all the towns. Now, Azotus is the Greek name for Ashdod. So amazingly, God sent Philip to preach the good news of Jesus in Ashdod and the surrounding area. I wonder, did Philip preach near the temple of Dagon? Were the superstitious people still jumping over the doorstep? I can imagine Philip in his preaching reminding the people of Ashdod what happened there over 500 years earlier and how they needed to remember the power of God that was shown by his victory over Dagon. I also wonder whether Philip reminded the people of Ashdod that Dagon was nailed to the temple wall. Did Philip use that as a way of contrasting Dagon with someone else who was held in place by nails? Jesus was nailed to a cross and died. But his broken body was put in the grave and didn't need someone else to pick him up. He rose victorious. And one day, God will be seen as fully victorious as the kingdom of Satan falls finally before the kingdom of Christ, just as Dagon fell before the ark. God was gracious. He still wanted the people of Ashdod to turn to him. He gave them a second chance. And God's gracious message is still the same today. It doesn't matter what you've done. However bad you've been, his message is, come to me in repentance and faith, and you'll find forgiveness through Jesus. But if you won't, then sadly one day you'll discover the same thing that the Philistines discovered, that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. No one can stand before him. The only way of escaping the judgment our sin deserves is by believing in Jesus, who had his hands nailed to Calvary's cross so that we could be set free from God's hand of judgment. And if you're not yet a Christian, then I urge you to turn to Jesus so that you can sing in the words of our next song. On that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied, for every sin on him was laid. Here in the death of Christ, I live.